Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate. And that's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank a three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
All right, we're here on It's My House. And this month of February 2022, we run a month-long series on slave entrepreneurs, Slave Entrepreneurship Month. This is Slave Entrepreneur Month here, as well as Black Towns History Month here, and Slave Artisanomics, Slave Artisanomics Month here as well. And we're running a series within all of this titled Think Like a Slave. Think Like a Slave. Now, yesterday, we covered Think Like a Slave, the inventors. You know, inventors are people that they solve problems. They come up with something, they invent something that solves problems. And many times, slaves, basically a lot of slaves were de facto engineers. They were de facto engineers, and they had to, you know, come up with ways to make things more efficient or profitable or what have you. So that's what we mean by think like a slave. They had to make bricks without straw, man. That's engineering. So today, yesterday we covered Think Like a Slave, the inventors, and we covered covered six of them yesterday. Well, today it's Think Like a Slave, the medical professionals. We're going to cover that round about the top of the hour. Until then, listen to this.
Wait a minute. You know my baby, she won't let me in. I've got a few pennies. I'm gonna buy myself a bottle of gin, and then I'm gonna call my buddy on the telephone and say, so hard all day long. Everything I try to do seems to always turn out wrong. That's why I want to stop by on my way home and say, now let me tell you one more thing. Have a little taste, but don't lose your cool and start messing up the man's place. Ain't no harm, take a little nip, but don't you fall down and bust your lip. No, no. Everybody on the come on and go with me. I'm gonna tell you one more time what I'm gonna do. Thank you.
Today, we're on the still on this series, within the series, Think Like a Slave. Yesterday was Think Like a Slave, the inventors, and we went through the bios of six people that started off life legally as a slave, but they became inventors. Some became wealthy people as well. With no internet connection, no electronics as we know them today, et cetera, et cetera. Today, we continue on our Think Like a Slave series, but today we're covering medical professionals. Think Like a Slave, the medical professionals. Yes, during slavery, you had slaves or people that started off life as a slave who became trained medical professionals. One of the ones that we're going to read off right now, and once again, we're on Wikipedia, as we use every day, so you can fact check me. And we've covered her before in our millionaire, we covered her in our Jim Crow Millionaire series, which is always ongoing. But now she's in our medical professional slave entrepreneur series too. Biddy Mason, B-I-D-D-Y, Biddy Mason, born Bridget Mason, August 15, 1818, sunset, January 15, 1891. Okay, let's get to it. Biddy Mason, or Bridget Biddy Mason, was born into slavery, reportedly on August 15, 1818, in Hancock County, Georgia, but her exact birthplace and birth date are unknown. At an early age, she was taken from her parents and moved to a plantation in another of another slave owner. Although records during her youth are incomplete, she spent most of her time on the plantation owned by Robert Smithson. During her teenage years, she learned the domestic and agricultural skills. Additionally, she developed skills as a herbal in herbal medicine and midwifery, taught to her by other female slaves. These skills were passed down from African, Caribbean, and Native American traditions. Her knowledge benefited both slaves and the plantation owners. According to some authors, Biddy was either given to, a soul to, Robert Mays Smith and his bride Rebecca Dorn Smith in the 1840s. Biddy was valuable to the Smiths because her knowledge of medicine, child care, and livestock care. Biddy had three children, Ellen, born about 1838, Anne, born about 1844, and Harriet, born in 1847. The fathers of her children are unknown, but some authors believe, but some authors have speculated that Robert M. Smith likely fathered at least one of her children. At 25 years old, a 25-year-old slave named Hannah worked with Biddy on the plantation. Like Biddy, Hannah had three of her own children. I don't know where that goes in with this, but just saying. Okay. Biddy Mason, and there's a picture of her on our scrolling marquee on Blog Talk Radio right now. Well, the next passage should explain it more. Freedom for her. In 1856, Smith moved to the slave state of Texas to sell slaves there. He sold slaves that would be free in Texas. Or he told the slaves that they would be free in Texas. Biddy relayed her fears of being separated from her children and remaining a slave to two black men, Charles Owens and Manuel Cooper. The men, including sheriffs and others, served Smith with a court order. A Los Angeles court heard that habeas corpus action regarding her freedom. That's right, Biddy did move it with a slave master to California, Southern California to be exact. All right, Smith claimed that Biddy wanted to go to Texas. He then bribed the lawyer to not show up. She was not allowed to testify in court since California law prohibited black people from testifying against white people. After Smith failed to appear in court on January 21, 1856, the judge presiding over the case, Benjamin Hayes, freed Biddy and family members. In 1860, Mason received a certified copy of a document that guaranteed her freedom. Biddy had no legal last name when she was enslaved. Okay. Los Angeles. After becoming free, Mason and her daughters moved in with Robert Owens, the father of Charles Owens, a well-known Los Angeles businessman. Her daughter, Ellen, would eventually marry Charles Owens. Mason worked in L.A., California, as a nurse and midwife. And that's why I titled today's podcast, The Medical Professionals. Because you did have people that were slaves or were bought or started out life as a slave who did, in fact, become medical professionals and were paid. They were even paid. You had slave midwives who were paid, but they were legally slaves. I'm just putting that out there. Because a lot of people believe that no slaves receive no type of payment. And for you ADOS people, how does that calculate into your reparations stuff? But that's another talk. All right. Mason worked in Los Angeles, California as a nurse. She got paid that way. She was essentially, as many nurses are today, she was a nurse entrepreneur. And she also specialized in midwifery. She was a midwife, delivering hundreds of babies during her career. Using her knowledge of herbal medicine, she risked her life to care for those affected by a smallpox epidemic in Los Angeles. One of her employers was a noted physician, John Strother Griffin. Saving carefully, she was one of the first African-American women to own land in Los Angeles. As a businesswoman, she had amassed a relatively large fortune, which she shared generously with charities. Mason also fed and sheltered the poor, visited prisoners. She was instrumental in founding the Travelers Aid Center and a school and a daycare center for black children open to any child who had nowhere to go. Because of her kind, giving spirit, she was called Annie Mason or Grandma Mason. In 1872, along with her son-in-law, Charles Owens, and other black residents of Los Angeles, California, Mason was a founding member of the first AME church, Episcopal Church, in Los Angeles, which was the city's first black church. The organizing meeting was held in her home on Spring Street. She donated the land on which the church was built. She also helped establish the first elementary school for black children in Los Angeles. Mason spoke fluent Spanish and was a well-known figure in the city. She dined on occasion at the home of Pio Pico, the last governor of Alta, California, and was a wealthy Los Angeles landowner. Okay, now Alta, California, A-L-T-A. Alta, California, also known as Nueva California, among other names, was a province of New Spain. This is when California was really California. Look it up, Alta, California, A-L-T-A, Alta, California, where the borders just expanded out. Brittany was really a pioneer's pioneer. All right. So, many slaves, particularly females, and I'm sure there were some males in there somewhere, when she was enslaved, she, in fact, earned a living for herself and her master, all in plain sight, no hiding, as a midwife. A midwife is a medical professional. All right? She was also a nurse. And in today's parlance, she would be an entrepreneur nurse. Cases, she did private duty. She was paid, as well as hundreds of other slaves who were midwives or nurses. I don't know what they call herbalists. Well, I guess they call them herbalists today. She was an herbalist also. We'll be back with more in a few minutes.
It ain't like stepping on eggs, Jake. Takes a man to kill. Are you man enough to kill, Jake? He'd be right there. Get me, Jack. Get me. Hit me. Hit me. You can't do it. Somebody drop this fool for me.
You got us twisted, homie. You gotta put your own work in around here.
It's like that, Bone?
It's like that.
Player to player, pimp to pimp. I'm leave you shoot me, nigga. Don't do it. Don't do it. Now I'm leave he got it in me, Jake. I'm going to get that gun, and then I'm going to get that money. And you ain't going to do a damn thing, because you ain't going to shoot no cop in the back, are you?
Don't do it.
You know what they give you for that? The gas chamber. You know what the gas chamber smells like? Pine oil. That's where you headed, boy, to pine oil heaven. I'm going to get that gun, and then I'm going to get that money. I don't believe you got it in you, Jake. I'm going to go get it right now.
Oh, shit! You motherfucker!
The next one will kill you.
Oh, son of a bitch! You shot me in the ass!
Okay, wait. Okay. All right, listen. Come on, Jake, I need the money. Give me the money, Jake.
Give me the money, please, Jay. Give me that money!
It's not going to happen.
Well, you want to jack me now? You want to take my own money from me, huh?
I told you, that's my evidence. You want to go to jail, you want to go home.
I want to go home, Jay. Come on, give me the money and let me go home.
Yeah? You want to go home?
Yeah, let me go home, Jay. Come on, give me the money and let me go home. Give me the money and let me go home. You don't deserve this. Okay, you motherfucker.
Jake, go ahead and bounce on me. Get up out of here. We got your back.
What?
Like that.
Oh, no, you didn't. Wait a minute. No, you didn't. Hey, Jake! Hey! Jake! 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 Come back here! Jake! You disloyal, fool-ass, bitch-made punk. Jake! I need my money! Jake! Oh, you motherfuckers. Okay. All right. I'm putting cases on all you bitches. Huh? You think you can do this shit? Jake! You think you can do this to me? You motherfuckers will be playing basketball in Pelican Bay when I get finished with you. Shoe program, nigga. 23-hour lockdown. I'm the man up in this piece. You'll never see the light of day. Who the fuck you think you fucking with? I'm the police. I run shit here. You just live here. Yeah, that's right. You better walk away. Go and walk away, because I'm going to burn this motherfucker down. King Kong ain't got shit on me. That's all right. Shit. I don't fuck. I'm winning any motherfucking way. I can't lose. Shit, you can shoot me, but you can't kill me. Shit. Oh, what a day. What a motherfucking day.
All right, that was Denzel Washington playing the rogue cop Alonzo in the film Training Day, which he won an Academy Award for that. Today, we're on our series here during Black Towns History Month, also Slave Entrepreneur Month here on It's My House. Today, we're running the series Think Like a Slave, and today's installment is Think Like a Slave, the Medical Professionals. Now, we just covered before the training day bit, talked about Bridget Biddy Mason, who was, she started out life as a slave, lived a significant portion of her life as a slave, became a medical professional as a slave. She was a midwife and a nurse. She had two ways to earn an income, okay? And this is why she's a slave. And when she finally got out to California, she became legally free, and she still had her skill sets of being a nurse and being a midwife, made her money. She was getting paid. She was paid as a slave, being a nurse, and being a midwife. She carried the same thing out to California, but in California, she took her money and invested it in land and real estate. She became wealthy. So one of the reasons why I'm running this month as Slave Entrepreneur Month, with this subsection of Think Like a Slave, because Madam C.J. Walker was not the first black female millionaire. She was not the first black millionaire in the United States. There were others before her. Bridget Biddy Mason was one of them. Now, let's get to another medical professional here. She was not born a slave. The next person we're going to read about, now, and all my stuff right here comes on Wikipedia. She was not born in slavery, but she was born in the Jim Crow era. Okay. And that's Margaret Charles Smith. And I have a picture, if you're on Blog Talk Radio, on our scrolling marquee, I have a picture of her, Margaret Charles Smith, along with Bridget Mason. You can see both of them on the scrolling marquee. Margaret Charles Smith, born September 12, 1906. Man, she lived, you got 98 years to November 12, 2004, was an African-American midwife. And that's a medical professional who was known for her extraordinary skill over a long career spanning over 30 years. Despite working primarily in rural areas with women who are often in poor health, she lost very few of the more than 3,000 babies she delivered. She was prolific. Okay. Let's see. In 1949, she became one of the first official midwives in Greene County, Alabama, and she was still practicing in 1976 when the state passed the law outlawing traditional midwifery. So she was a pioneer, right? She got in it when it was good, people. In the 1990s, she co-wrote a book about her career, which you can get today, titled Listen to Me Good, The Life Story of an Alabama Midwife. And in 2010, she was inducted into the Alabama Women's Hall of Fame. Let's see. Early life, Margaret Charles Smith was born in Eutaw, Alabama. That's in the western part of the state. You know what? That's an interesting town I would like to visit. But that's another story. About 3 weeks from Smith's birth, however, her mother, Beulah Saunders, passed away. After the death of her mother, Smith was raised by her grandparents on their farm in Eutaw, Alabama. The grandparents were local farmers, and her grandmother, Margaret Charles, was a former slave and midwife. So she learned to trade from her grandmother. She attended a rural grammar school in her hometown of Eutaw, Alabama, but the demands of farming sometimes interrupted her schooling. And she left school entirely at the age of 16 when her grandfather died. Let's see. Margaret Charles Smith, also known as Miss Margaret, was first introduced to midwifery around the age of 5 years old. Smith said her first midwifery experience was assisting at the bedside during the birth of an infant of her future husband-to-be, big cousin's wife. Smith caught the infant as the birth was taking place before the midwife was able to make her arrival to the home. She became interested in midwifery in her teens, but didn't begin training until her late 30s, with a local midwife named Ella Anderson. In 1949, Greene County issued a permit to Smith to practice midwifery, making her one of the county's first official midwives. In that area, granny midwives, as late African-American midwives like Smith were informally called, were crucial to the lives of Southern black women because most of the hospitals would not admit them as patients. And that's why I've titled this series, Think Like a Slave. The ingenuity of many slaves was that they had to find a way and make a way when one way was not available. They had to learn how to make bricks without straw. And she did, and many others did. Some of these people had to invent industries. They had to invent jobs. She couldn't go to the government. Reparations wasn't happening then. And it's 2022 right now. And, well, that's we're not even going to go down that road for now, at least. But she was one of the people that Margaret Charles Smith, that she's a pioneer. Let's see. Right, in 1976, Alabama outlawed traditional wifery. Typically happens when, you know, when the local politicians or legislators, they don't get their cut of money, then they outlaw shit. And they would probably, even in the hospitals, would try, you know, they're looking at, they realize that these women, a lot of these midwives got wealthy, man. So let's outlaw it and then take on that profit center. All right, so in 1976, Alabama outlawed traditional midwifery, but Smith was allowed to continue for a while due to her experience. She received her last permit to practice midwifery in 1981. The state of Alabama later passed laws allowing nurse midwives to practice in hospitals. So obviously some lobbying was going on for that to happen. In 1996, Smith co-wrote a book about her life titled Listen to Me, The Life Story of an Alabama Midwife. All right. Her personal life during Smith's school years, age years, she met a man named Randolph Smith in one of her room segregated schoolhouses, in a one-room segregated schoolhouse. Man, this is crazy. He got a one-room classroom. I guess it's blacks on this side of the room, and on the other side of the room is white folks. All right. In Utah, Alabama, and ended up falling in love. Against the wishes of her grandmother, Margaret Smith, the couple arrived in 1943... Okay, the couple resided in Smith's grandmother's farm, on Smith's grandmother's farm, where Randolph Smith ended up taking up hog farming, which led to that being the main source of income for the Smith family. Smith gave birth to three sons, Spencer Charles, Hudson Charles, and Herman Smith. Her first son was born while she was still in her teens. She served as her own midwife for her second birth. Her others accompanied by midwives. She served as the midwife for the firstborn daughter of her son Spencer and his wife Betty. The tradition continued. With her being present at the birth of her granddaughter's first child. Margaret Charles Smith and her family continued to farm at the estate in the in Eutaw, Alabama, throughout Smith's life, just before her death. And you know what? Well, she lived to be 98. And I'm aware of Eutaw, Alabama. That's near. That's not too far from Bossier, Alabama. Man, those are like black townships, man. In 2022. And, you know, thank you, Pleasant Stevens, for that, because he turned me on to Bossier, Alabama. We had the mayor of Bossier, Alabama, which is a neighboring town of Eutaw, Alabama, here a few years ago. And you know what? I got to call Pleasant again today because we got to get his wife on, who is from Mount Bayou, Mississippi. So the just as a quick review, today's series, and we're doing a sub-series within our Slave Entrepreneur Month, the Think Like a Slave series. Here's what we've got so far. Yesterday, we covered Think Like a Slave, the Black Inventors. And many of your black inventors we featured six people yesterday. All six people were born into slavery, legally born into it, okay? And some, while they were still legally slaves, started to invent things. Basically, at least all the six ones I read yesterday, you can call them de facto engineers. What do engineers do? Engineers solve problems. They come up with new gadgets or devices that solve problems. So we featured six yesterday. Once again, which is why I don't watch Hollywood movies. I don't watch Hollywood slave movies because they're not coming out with anything, nor would I expect them to feature slaves in a positive light. Once again, every last one of the inventors that I brought out here yesterday, all the black inventors, all that were born into slavery, some invented stuff while they were still legally slaves. That's why I called each and last one of the six yesterday de facto engineers. Today, we covered two people. One was born a slave. That's Bridget Biddy Mason. Born a slave, but she earned money. Matter of fact, all six people that I featured yesterday earned money legally while they were slaves. Because I want to bust down the myth that slaves didn't get paid. Now, granted, some were not paid. But there were many, many people that were legally slaves that did get paid. All six that I mentioned yesterday were paid. And I'm reading all this stuff from Wikipedia. And the two people that I mentioned today as slaves, all right, well, one was born a slave and one was born during Jim Crow. She wasn't legally, she was never a slave in her lifetime. Bridget Biddy Mason earned money when she was a slave as a nurse and a midwife. Those were her two primary ways of earning income legally as a slave. Now, here's how that worked. And Pianchi threw out something at me the other day that I need to bring out here right now. Intrapreneurship. A lot of us have heard of the term entrepreneur or entrepreneurship. Well, a lot of slaves, the ones I'm talking about who got paid, all six of them yesterday, and Bridget Biddy Mason, who I've talked about today, they were all entrepreneurs in some kind of way. Now, what is an entrepreneur? And once again, I'm reading off of Wikipedia. Entrepreneurship is the act of behaving like an entrepreneur while working within a large organization. Now, let me break this down for slave days. Many people who owned slaves, the way they made money is that they would hire out their slaves. So in the case of Bridget Betty Mason, who was a nurse and a midwife, her master or masters along the way could hire her out, could subcontract her out to somebody who needed nursing services or midwife services. And a lot of times that was all paid now. And a lot of times the slave master would be a de facto employment agency. Just like Kelly's today or Olson's today. They would supply the human resource, which was the slave, the chattel slave, and they would get paid, and then they would keep some money, and they would typically give people like Bridget Betty Mason a paycheck too. When slavery was abolished, when Betty Mason made it out to California, and she was legally free, she no longer needed a middleman to collect her money. She can go direct, principal to principal. She did that. She kept all of the pie. She just didn't get some of the pie as she did in slavery. And she used that money to invest in land and real estate and got wealthy. And that's the person who started out as a slave. All right. There were many others who did the same thing. This is all before Madam C.J. Walker, way before that. All right. So Betty Mason and some of the people that we read, all six of the people that we read yesterday, they were intrapreneurs. Like Ben Montgomery. Benjamin Montgomery, who I read, you know, who talk about reparations. And reparations comes in many different forms. He started off life in slaves, and he ended up running the plantation that he was a slave on. He ran a general store as an intrapreneur. Later on, he became an entrepreneur, and his son, Isaiah Montgomery, ended up building the town. This is why we got Pleasant Stephens' wife on the show. Of Mound Bayou, Mississippi, which still exists to this day. Read up on it. Entrepreneurship. Many slaves did become, in fact, entrepreneurs before they became their own entrepreneur. But you're not going to see that with LeVar Burton on Roots and his portrayal of Kunta Kinte, but that's okay. That's all right. Now, the second person that we talked about today, real quickly as a review, Charles Margaret Smith, she was not born a slave, but she was born during Jim Crow era. And she delivered over 3,000 babies. And she was paid for most of those. And I'm saying most because I doubt she charged deliver for, you know, her grandson, and she was present for that, and probably some other family members. But she saw over 3,000, she got paid for over 3,000 that came in. And there were others like that. I know when I visited, and we've had the mayor of Taft, Oklahoma on here about 5-6 times. And, I've been out to Taft several times and got some property out that way. Her mother was a midwife. So that's how a lot of them, they got paid. Tomorrow we'll continue the, and once again, the think like a slave. See, I want to bust that myth out. Because basically, slaves, the Underground Railroad When I say think like a slave, you have to look at the resilience of slaves. You had to, yesterday we featured six people that were born into slavery and became inventors because, and I say they were de facto engineers because engineers solve problems. You know, Eli Whitney is given credit for the cotton gin because he got to the patent office, the trademark office first, or the patent office first. But it was somebody working on his estate or whatever that really came up with it. I'm doing research on that. And that's how a lot of these black inventors, they were basically de facto engineers. All right. Betty Mason, as well as Margaret Charles Smith, they knew something about herbal medicine. Because back, you know, back when they were operating during slavery and during the, you know, early Jim Crow era, they black women were not allowed in the hospital. All right, so what do? You know, they had to, you know, they had to come up with creative ways in order to get the problem solved. And a big part of that was, you know, they weren't allowed in the hospital, and they couldn't get their hands on prescription medication. Well, they were trained in herbal medicine. All right, and they weren't going to Harvard Law School. I mean, it's not law school. They weren't going to Harvard Medical School, or UCLA Medical School, or USC Medical School. They weren't going. They had to come up with their own stuff that worked. And herbal medicine has been around thousands of years before Western medicine. So yesterday we covered the inventors. Today we covered the medical professionals. Just two of the medical professionals. And then tomorrow we'll cover another group of professionals that got paid and I got the door open. I was wondering. I was hearing this noise in the background. It's the front door's open and the wind's blowing. And we'll cover another group of people that were paid while they were slaves. Because we're covering stuff that you typically don't. I mean, I don't think you would normally hear. During what they call Black History Month. Any comments? 619-768-2945. If you got any comments you want to add in, particularly if it pertains to medical professionals or slaves who became medical professionals during slavery or even Jim Crow.
And now, an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Up from Slavery, Chapter 10, A Harder Task Than Making Bricks Without Straw. From the very beginning at Tuskegee, I was determined to have the students do not only the agricultural and domestic work, but to have them erect their own buildings. My plan was to have them, while performing a service, taught the latest and best methods of labor, so that the school would not only get the benefit of their efforts, but the students themselves would be taught to see not only the utility in labor, but beauty and dignity. Would be taught, in fact, how to lift labor up from the mere drudgery and toil, and would learn to love work for its own sake. My plan was not to teach them the work in the old way, but to show them how to make the forces of nature, air, water, steam, electricity, horsepower, assist them in their labor. At first, many advised against the experiment of having the buildings erected by the labor of the students, but I was determined to stick to it. I told those who doubted the wisdom of the plan that I knew that our first buildings would not be so comfortable or so complete in their finish as buildings erected by the experienced hands of outside workmen, but that in the teaching of civilization, self-help, and self-reliance, the erection of the buildings by the students themselves would more than compensate for any lack of comfort or fine finish. I further told those who doubted the wisdom of the plan that the majority of our students came to us in poverty from the cabins of the cotton, sugar, and rice plantations of the South, and that while I knew that it would please the students very much to place them at once in finely constructed buildings, I felt that it would be following out of more natural process of development to teach them how to construct their own buildings. Mistakes I knew would be made, but these mistakes would teach us valuable lessons for the future. During the now 19 years existence of the Tuskegee School, the plan of having the buildings erected by student labor has been adhered to. In this time, 40 buildings, counting small and large, have been built, and all except four are almost wholly the product of student labor. As an additional result, hundreds of men are now scattered throughout the South who received their knowledge of mechanics while being taught how to erect these buildings. Skill and knowledge are now handed down from one set of students to another in this way, until at the present time, a building of any description or size can be constructed wholly by our instructors and students, from the drawing of the plans to the putting in of the electric fixtures, without going off the grounds for a single workman. Not a few times when a new student has been led into the temptation of marring the looks of some building by lead pencil marks or by the cuts of a jackknife, I have heard an old student remind him, "Don't do that. That is our building, and I helped to put it up." In the early days of the school, I think my most trying experience was in the matter of brick making. As soon as we got the farm work reasonably well started, we directed our next efforts toward the industry of making bricks. We needed these for use in connection with the erection of our own buildings, but There was also another reason for establishing this industry. There was no brickyard in the town. And in addition to our own needs, there was a demand for bricks in the general market. I had always sympathized with the children of Israel in their task of making bricks without straw. But ours was a task of making bricks with no money and no experience. In the first place, the work was hard and dirty, and it was difficult to get the students to help. When it came to brickmaking, their distaste for manual labor in connection with book education became especially manifest. It was not a pleasant task for one to stand in the mud pit for hours with the mud up to his knees. More than one man became disgusted and left the school. We tried several locations before we opened up a pit that furnished brick clay. I had always supposed that brickmaking was a very simple, but I soon found out by bitter experience that it required special skill and knowledge, particularly in the burning of the bricks. After a good deal of effort, we molded about 25,000 bricks and put them into a kiln to be burned. This kiln turned out to be a failure because it was not properly constructed or properly burned. We began at once, however, on a second kiln. Now, this for some reason also proved a failure. The failure of this kiln made it still more difficult to get the students to take any part in the work. Several of the teachers, however, who had been trained in the industries at Hampton, volunteered their services, and in some way we succeeded in getting a third kiln ready for burning. Now, the burning of a kiln requires about a week. Toward the latter part of the week, when it seemed as if we were going to have a good many thousand bricks in a few hours, in the middle of the night, the kiln fell. For the third time, we had failed. The failure of this last kiln left me without a single dollar with which to make another experiment. Most of the teachers advised the abandoning of the effort to make bricks. In the midst of my troubles, I thought of a watch which had come into my possession years ago. I took this watch to the city of Montgomery, which was not far distant. I placed it in a pawn shop. I secured cash upon it to the amount of $15 with which to renew the brickmaking experiment. I returned to Tuskegee, and with the help of the $15, rallied our rather demoralized and discouraged forces and began a fourth attempt to make bricks. This time, I am glad to say we were successful. Before I got a hold of any money, the time limit on the watch had expired, and I've never seen it since. But I have never regretted the loss of it. Brickmaking has now become such an important industry at the school that last season our students manufactured 1,200,000 of first-class bricks of a quality suitable to be sold in any market. Aside from this, the scores of young men have mastered the brickmaking trade, both the making of bricks by hand and by machinery, and are now engaged in the industry in many parts of the South. The making of these bricks taught me an important lesson in regard to the relations of the two races in the South. Many white people who had no contact with the school, and perhaps no sympathy with it, came to us to buy bricks because they found out that ours were as good were good bricks. They discovered that we were supplying a real want in the community. The making of these bricks caused many of the white residents of the neighborhood to begin to feel that the education of the Negro was not making him worthless. But in educating our students, we were adding something to the wealth and comfort of the community. As the people of the neighborhood came to us to buy bricks, we got acquainted with them. They traded with us and we with them. Our business interests became intermingled. We had something which what they wanted. They had something which we wanted. This in a large measure helped to lay the foundation for the pleasant relations that have continued to exist between us and the white people in that section, and which now extended throughout the South. Wherever one of the brickmack makers has gone in the South, we find that he has something to contribute to the well-being of the community into which he has gone, something that has made the community feel that in a degree it is indebted to him and perhaps to a certain extent dependent upon him. In this way, pleasant relations between the races have been stimulated. My experience is that there is something in human nature which always makes an individual recognize and reward merit, no matter under what color of skin merit is found. I have found, too, that it is the visible and tangible that goes a long ways in softening prejudices. The actual sight of a first-class house that a Negro has built is 10 times more potent than pages of discussion about a house that he ought to build, or perhaps could build. The same principle of industrial education has been carried out in the building of our own wagons, carts, and buggies from the first. We now own and use on our farm and about the school dozens of these vehicles, and every one of them has been built by the hands of the students. Aside from this, we help supply the local market with the vehicles. The supplying of them to the people in the community has had the same effect as the supplying of bricks, and a man who learns at Tuskegee to build and repair wagons and carts is regarded as a benefactor by both races in the community where he goes. The people with whom he lives and works are going to think twice before they part with such a man. The individual who can do something that the world wants done will, in the end, make his way regardless of his race. One man may go into the community prepared to supply the people there with an analysis of Greek sentences. The community may not at all that time be prepared for it or feel the need of Greek analysis, but it may feel its needs of bricks and houses and wagons. If the man can supply the need for those, then it will lead eventually to a demand for the first product, and with the demand will come the ability to appreciate it and to profit by it. About the time that we succeeded in burning our first kiln of bricks, we began facing in an emphasized form the objection of the students to being taught to work. By this time, it had gotten to be pretty well advertised throughout the state that every student who came to Tuskegee, no matter what his financial ability might be, must learn some industry. Quite a number of letters came from parents protesting against their children engaging in labor while they were in school. Other parents came to the school to protest in person. Most of the new students brought a written or verbal request from their parents to the effect that they wanted their children taught nothing but books. The more books, the larger they were, and the longer the titles printed upon them, the better pleased the students and their parents seemed to be. I gave little heed to those protests, except that I lost no opportunity to go into as many parts of the state as I could for the purpose of speaking to the parents and showing them that the value of industrial education. Besides, I talked to the students constantly on the subject. Notwithstanding the unpopularity of industrial work, the school continued to increase in numbers to such an extent that by the middle of the second year, there was an attendance of about 150, representing almost all parts of the state of Alabama, and including a few from other states. In the summer of 1882, Ms. Davidson and I both went north and engaged in the work of raising funds for the completion of our new building. On my way north, I stopped in New York to try to get a letter of recommendation from an officer of a missionary organization who had become somewhat acquainted with me a few years previous. This man was not only refused to give me the letter, but advised me most earnestly to go back home at once and not make an attempt to get money, for he was quite sure that I would never get more than enough to pay my traveling expenses. I thanked him for his advice and proceeded on my journey. The first place I went to the north was Northampton, Massachusetts, where I spent nearly a half day in looking for a colored family with whom I could board, never dreaming that any hotel would admit me. I was greatly surprised when I found that I would have no trouble in being accommodated at a hotel. We were successful in getting money enough so that on Thanksgiving Day of that year, we held our first service in the chapel of Porter Hall, although the building was not completed. In looking about for someone to preach the Thanksgiving sermon, I found one of the rarest men that it has ever been my privilege to know. This was Reverend Robert C. Bedford, a white man from Wisconsin, who was the pastor of a little colored congregational church in Montgomery, Alabama. Before going to Montgomery to look for someone to preach the sermon, I had never heard of Mr. Bedford, and he had never heard of me. He gladly consented to come to Tuskegee and hold a Thanksgiving service. It was the first service of the kind that the colored people there had ever observed, and what a deep interest they manifested in it. The sight of the new building made it a day of Thanksgiving for them, never to be forgotten. Mr. Bedford consented to become one of the trustees of the school, and in that capacity, and as a worker for it, he has been connected with it for 18 years. During this time, he has borne the school upon his heart night and day, and is never so happy as when he is performing some service, no matter how humble for it. He completely obliterates himself and everything and looks only for permission to serve where service is most disagreeable and where others would not be attracted. He, in all my relations with him, he has seemed to me to approach as nearly to the spirit of the master as almost any man I ever met. A little later, there came into the service of school another man, quite young at the time and fresh from Hampton, without whose service to school never could have become what it is, and this was Mr. Warren Logan, who now for 17 years has been the treasurer of the Institute and the acting principal during my absence. He has always shown a degree of unselfishness and an amount of business tact, coupled with a clear judgment, that has kept the school in good condition, no matter how long I have been absent from it. During all the financial stress through which the school has passed, his patience and faith in our ultimate success have not left him. As soon as our first building was near enough to completion so that we could occupy a portion of it, which was nearly the middle of the second year of the school, we opened a boarding department. Students had begun coming from quite a distance and in such increasing numbers that we felt more and more that we were merely skimming over the surface and that we were not getting a hold of the students in their home life. We had nothing but the students and their appetites with which to begin a boarding department. No provision had been made in the new building for a kitchen and dining room, but we discovered that by digging out a large amount of earth from under the building, we could make a partially lighted basement room that could be used for a kitchen and a dining room. Again, I called on the students to volunteer for work, this time to assist in digging out the basement. This they did, and in a few weeks we had a place to cook and eat in, although it was very rough and uncomfortable. Anyone seeing the place now would never believe that it was once used for a dining room. The most serious problem, though, was to get the boarding department started off in running order, with nothing to do within the way of furniture and with no money with which to buy anything. The merchants in the town would let us have the food that we wanted on credit. In fact, in those early years, I was constantly embarrassed because people seemed to have more faith in me than I had in myself. It was pretty hard to cook, however, without stoves, and awkward to eat without dishes. At first, the cooking was done outdoors and in old-fashioned, primitive style in pots and skillets placed over a fire. Some of the carpenter's benches that had been used in the construction of the building were utilized for tables. As for dishes, there were too few to make it worthwhile to spend time in describing them. Not one connected with the boarding department seemed to have any idea that meals must be served at certain fixed and regular hours, and that was a source of great worry. Everything was so out of joint and so inconvenient that I feel safe in saying that there for the first 2 weeks, something was wrong at every meal. Either the meat was not done, or we had been burnt, or the salt had been left out of the bread, or the tea had been forgotten. Early one morning, I was standing near the dining room door listening to the complaints of the students. The complaints that morning were especially emphatic and numerous because the whole breakfast had been a failure. One of the girls who had failed to get any breakfast came out and went to the well to draw some water to drink to take the place of breakfast, which she had not been able to get. When she reached the well, she found that the rope was broken and that she could get no water. She turned from the well and said, in the most discouraged tone, not knowing that I was where I could hear her, "We can't even get water to drink at this school." I think no one remark ever came so near discouraging me as that one. At another time, when Mr. Bedford, whom I had already spoken of as one of our trustees and devoted friend of the institution, was visiting the school, he was given a bedroom immediately over the dining room. Early in the morning, he was awakened by a rather animated discussion between two boys in the dining room below. The discussion was over the question as to whose turn it was to use the coffee cup that morning. One boy won the case by proving that for 3 mornings, he had not had an opportunity to use the cup at all. But gradually, by patience and hard work, we brought order out of chaos, just as will be true of any problem if we stick to it with patience and wisdom and earnest effort. As I look back now over the part of our struggle, I'm glad that we had it. I'm glad that we endured all those discomforts and inconveniences. I'm glad that our students had to dig out the place for the kitchen and dining room I'm glad that our first boarding place was in that dismal, ill-lighted, and damp basement. Had we started in a fine, attractive, convenient room, I fear we would have lost our heads and become stuck up. It means a great deal, I think, to start off on a foundation which one has made for oneself. When our old students return to Tuskegee now, as they often do, and go into our large, beautiful, well-ventilated, and well-lighted dining room, and see tempting, well-cooked food, largely grown by the students themselves, and see tables, neat tablecloths and napkins, and vases of flowers upon the tables, and hear singing birds, and note that each meal is observed exactly upon the minute, with no disorder, and with almost no complaint coming from the hundreds that now fill our dining room, they too often say to me that they were glad that we started as we did, and built ourselves up over year by year by a slow and natural process of growth.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this because it remains the property of the client. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working, and then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now.
Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technicians, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better. And so I get more customers.